offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. As always, this is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, here to continue this pilgrimage, as we call it, something that we do together, that we progress and learn together, and that is the whole idea of the series. A series in which we take the verses of the Bhagavad Gita one by one, try to understand them, and also try to understand them in the context of Swami's message. That is a very, very important point. In fact, I think I will be making a mention of that in the course of today's program, why it is important to look at even a text like Bhagavad Gita, which is universally proclaimed to be a very, very spiritual text, from the viewpoint of the words of the Guru, from the words of Swami. I think that is another point we will touch upon, but that's what we try to do in this program, don't we? We, of course, try to go into each meaning and each word's meaning and try to understand it, but all through our beacon of light or our guiding light has always been Swami's words. So I join you all in offering my heartfelt gratitude to Swami for this. We are still in the second chapter, and I think towards the second half of the second chapter, we'll probably start, as always, with a short summary of what we covered last week. We went through three verses again last week, verses number 49, 50 and 51 of the second chapter. In verse number 49, Krishna makes two very important statements. He says, doing actions with yoga buddhi is far superior to doing regular karma that is driven by our raga and dvesha, or what we have defined as likes and dislikes. He then goes on to say that doing actions in a normal way is a sign of miserliness. I think that's the word he used. Of course, earlier he did say that it's a sign of foolishness and all of that, but in this particular verse he says it's a sign of miserliness. And we discussed what is the import of this particular statement. It means that it is not that we are incapable of performing karma yoga. We all are in fact capable of doing that, but we are happy doing normal karma, which is far, far inferior. This is almost like a rich man who refuses to spend even though he has the ability to spend more, right? That is the definition of miserliness. And this is because we discussed how a miser gets confused as to what is the purpose of money or what is money meant for. Money is not meant to be hoarded, money is meant to be spent. As Swami would always say, money is like water, it has to keep flowing, and that is how it will stay fresh. The moment it starts stagnating, then it starts giving out a foul odor. So in that sense, money is meant to be spent. Money is meant to be spent for legitimate uses. But if a miser starts hoarding the money and tends to think that that is what money is meant for, so there is a confusion of the purpose of what money is meant for. And in a very, very similar manner, karma is meant for a certain purpose. And when we are doing karma in a normal fashion, we are not using it for that purpose, right? And as we saw, the purpose of karma itself is to attain chitta shuddhi. And if we are not doing that, we have lost the context of what karma is for. And of course, Krishna ends that particular shloka by advising Arjuna that you must take resort in wisdom, or in other words, choose to be wise. It is a conscious decision that one has to make, a conscious choice that one has to make, that I want to do karma in this manner. So that's what he says, you must take this choice, or you should make this choice of leading life like this. In the 50th verse, Krishna speaks of again the ultimate achievement of a karma yogi, because a karma yogi performs actions for chitta shuddhi. And that is what he or she ends up achieving. It is then when the chitta shuddhi is attained that the mind has been prepared for the ultimate wisdom, right? That's what we had spoken and discussed about last week. And when that wisdom is attained, one goes beyond actions that are good and bad. Jahati iha ubhe sukrata duskrite. That's what Krishna says. That is the ultimate attainment of a person who performs karma yoga, that he reaches a state which is beyond meritorious actions and sinful actions. This is the ultimate benefit that a karma yogi gets, But Krishna, in this particular verse, also says, what is the current benefit? When a karma yogi operates in this manner, what is the current benefit that he accrues out of performing deeds with this buddhi yoga? When one is not interested in any particular outcome and is absolutely focused only on the task at hand, there will be no distractions, right? That is simple. And when there are no distractions, there will be excellence in whatever that person is doing. So buddhi yoga will express itself as excellence in karma. Yoga karma sukaushalam. Right? That is what Krishna says in the 50th verse. In the next verse, Krishna speaks about the benefits again of performing actions like this. He says karmajam. Karmajam is results of karma. And in general, results of karma is bondage, because every karma comes with consequence. Good karma comes with good consequence, bad karma comes with bad consequence, but everything comes with a consequence, and that consequence tends to bind us up. So in general, karmajam leads to bondage. The result of karma leads to bondage. But the karmajam of a person who is a buddhi yukta, that is one who is having spiritual intelligence, phalam tyaktva, one who has given up the fruits, and manishinaha, one who is wise, the karmajam of such a person will not bind, but will end up releasing the person from birth and death. So that is the offer that Krishna is making. He's saying that you can either do karma in the normal manner and get bound by it, or you can do the same karma. You don't have to do a different karma. You can do the same karma with this new perspective of yoga buddhi, and you will be released from birth and death. And that's the final discussion that we had last week. Here is Arjuna in front of him. In fact, Arjuna wants to do something different. Arjuna wants to become a sannyasi. But Krishna is telling him, you don't have to do anything different. The actions that you perform need not change, but the mentality or the perspective with which you perform those actions have to change. So that is what Krishna is saying, that you don't have to do something different, but you have to do whatever you're doing differently. And that is what karma yoga is all about. And when it is done that way, the same karmas that can bind end up releasing the person from birth and death. So those were the verses that we covered last week, 49, 50 and 51. We will progress to the verses 52 and thereafter today. As Swami very beautifully describes in the Gita Vahini, this particular part of the second chapter has three or four distinct modules. And one is, of course, the Sankhya Yoga. We've seen that at the end of it, Krishna himself says that this is Sankhya, which I've taught you. Then comes the part where he speaks about Buddhi Yoga, the attitude with which one must go around doing actions. And then that again comes down to Karma Yoga part, where it is a little more practical. That's what we've gone through. And this is the part where that ends the whole description of what Krishna has been telling about the Karma Yoga and how a Karma Yogi acts. And the last module is, of course, the module on the Stita Prajna, where there is a discussion between Krishna and Arjuna about who is a Stita Prajna, how do you identify a Stita Prajna. I think we will probably start that part also today. So when we are going through these two verses, 52 and 53, we have to keep in mind that this is more or less a kind of summary of the two parts of the Buddhi Yoga and the Karma Yoga part, which Krishna has been explaining. So we listen to verse number 52, as always, very clearly rendered by Brother Shyam, one of our alumnus. And after that, I'll give you a brief meaning of that verse, and then we'll go into the in-depth meaning.
Yada te moha kalilam buddhir vyatitarishyati tada gantasi nirvedam shrotavyasya shrutasya cha.
When your mind will go beyond the turbidity of delusion, then you will acquire dispassion for what has to be heard and what has been heard. So as we've been seeing in the past few verses, Krishna is describing the nature of one who is operating with Buddha Yoga, right? That's what we've been seeing so far. He says that they go beyond good and bad, they go beyond birth and death, and there will be perfection in their action, yoga karma sukaushalam, and so on. In continuation of all those descriptions, Krishna says in this particular verse, yada, when ते बुद्धि ही योर डिस्क्रिमिनेशन व्यतितरिष्यति ट्रांसेंड्स और ओवरकम्स मोह कलिलम द मोरास ऑफ डिल्यूशन और द टिकेट ऑफ डिल्यूशन. मोह मीन्स डिल्यूशन, मोह कलिलम मीन्स इट्स लाइक अ थिक फॉरेस्ट ऑफ डिल्यूशन. दैट्स द बेस्ट वर्ड यू कैन यूज. और द टर्बिडिटी ऑफ डिल्यूशन व्हेन वाटर इज टर्बिड. When you go beyond that moha kalilam, tada, then gantasi nirvedam, you will develop dispassion towards shrotavyasya, what you will be hearing, shrutasya cha, and what you have already heard. We must remember that Krishna is all this while speaking of the ultimate benefits of buddhir yoga, right? Not all of us may necessarily be interested in moksha or liberation or transcending birth and death. I think that idea itself comes after a lot of sadhana. Even that prayer that we can make to Swami saying that, Swami, I don't want to be born again. I'm not sure how many of us are really in that state already. I can talk for myself. It doesn't come so spontaneously that I don't stand in front of Swami and say, Swami, let this be my last birth, or Swami, let me transcend birth and death. Swami, please grant me moksha. Even that idea or even that desire for the ultimate comes only with Swami's blessings, as Swami says. And that blessing comes when the sadhaka has gone through enormous amounts of sadhana, right? And that's a gift of grace. But we all may know that that is the ultimate, right? Theoretically and through our reading knowledge, we know that that is the ultimate. So if I'm going to take to some path, whether it is bhakti or karma or whatever is the path, or someone comes and says that this is a new meditation technique, though I might not have the desire for the ultimate right now, I want to ensure that this path will finally lead me to the ultimate, right? This is, sometimes we call it future-proofing, right? Even when we buy a software, we might not use all the features, but we want the software to have all the features so that in the future, if I might need this particular feature, I should not necessarily go and again start looking for another software or something like that. Or even when we buy a gadget, or even when you buy a car, we want features in that, even those we might not use immediately, but in the future we might find a need for that. So in that sense, when Krishna speaks about karma yoga, he says that it can give you the ultimate, right? It can help you transcend sukrita and dushkrita, sin and merit. It can help you attain padam, he had said in the previous verse, the ultimate state. In other words, as I had explained the last time, karma yoga prepares the mind, it gives chitta shuddhi, which is a prerequisite for the ultimate wisdom. So it is telling you that it will give you the ultimate if you go on this, even though right now you may or may not be having that desire in your mind. So forget perfect purity of the mind for now, right? As I said, we are not yet thinking of the ultimate, we are not thinking of the ultimate wisdom, moksha, or even perfect chitta shuddhi, maybe we are not even thinking of that. But we all are, to a small extent, taking baby steps in the spiritual path. We have decided that we want to lead a spiritual life, or we want to do some sadhana, right? So we all, in that sense, are on the path of spirituality and making our own little efforts, faltering in our steps, falling down maybe, but we are still making those small steps. Sometimes that doubt would come whether this effort is really worth it, right? I'm having a weekend, and instead of having fun like all the other colleagues of mine or all my other classmates, why should I spend my time doing bhajans, or why should I spend my time doing seva? Why should I spend my time listening to Radio Sai, or, you know, sitting and reading some book by Swami? This doubt would sometimes come, right? Or should I go back to leading a life, pursuing wealth and success just like others are doing? It is not uncommon in that sense. It is because the mind is always going outward. That is the nature of the mind. And the mind gets distracted by what it sees. And that is what leads to confusion. And the mind always seeks for inputs from outside. And let's say when we see a person appearing to be happy, leading a life of fulfillment in the worldly path, right? Because at the end of the day, we all are trying to be happy with ourselves, trying to be satisfied. And if we find a person who is absolutely not having any spiritual component in his or her life, who is really leading a life full of party and merriment and all that, when you see a person like that, when they appear to be happy, it distracts the mind. It says that, you know, what am I doing? Probably that person is happier than me. and I am doing all of this spiritual gymnastics, and this person is not at all bothered by that, but that person seems to be happy, right? The mind will start questioning and doubting those little steps in the spiritual path that we are taking. For instance, let's say that people like us, we are all living in the ashram. In a moment of inspiration, we say that, oh, we want to lead a simple life, and we want to lead a life of simple living and high thinking, as Swami would say, right? In an emotional moment, maybe we take a decision. But every time we find somebody of our same age who's probably doing very well in their career, or who comes and says, you know what, I bought this luxury car, I bought this huge apartment, it is very common for the mind to start questioning the choices that it has already made. And that is why Swami would always insist on good company. And good company is not about that person being good or bad. Good company is nothing but that company in which we tend to stay on the path. That company which helps us focus on the goal, focus on God, and reaffirm the right choices that we have made. That is good company. And bad company is not necessarily bad people, right? You might have a perfectly good gentleman, but he might be bad company to you if he is distracting me from my spiritual path that I have set for myself, right? And that is why Swami would insist on satsangam, right? Satsangatve nissangatvam, nissangatve nirmohatvam, nirmohatve nischalatatvam. So to get that nirmohatvam, which Krishna is speaking about, it all starts with satsang. Swami would often give a very, very beautiful analogy. Of course, all analogies of Swami are so captivating, and this is one of that. He would say, it's like you lighting a small lamp with a small flame, and you keep it in the middle of the house. Now imagine all the doors and windows of the house is open. In those days, you would have this central porch, and the whole house will be built around it. There'll be a central part of the house, which will have an open sky or something like that, or a common space in the center. So imagine you light a lamp and you put it in the center, and there would be doors on all four sides. There would be windows on all four sides. If you do that, what will happen is, you know, Swami says, with the breeze blowing constantly all through from the windows and doors, this lamp will start flickering. So what do? You immediately close all the doors and windows. But that doesn't mean that you will never open the windows and doors. The moment someone comes and somebody who has to be allowed inside comes, you open the door. Right? So Swami would say the door has two purposes. The door is meant to stop those who should not come in from coming in. And the door is also a means through which somebody who has to come in has to come in. And Swami would say the doors are the senses. Right? The entrance to the house, the windows and all of that are the senses. You allow, and sometimes you need the breeze also, right? You open the window so that you can allow a little bit of breeze to come in. But you ensure all the while that this lamp or this flickering flame does not get put off or does not get strained too much, right? Similarly, when we want to lead a purposeful life, if we keep listening to everyone, taking in through our eyes all kinds of information, and listening through our ears all kinds of information from others, this resolve that we have taken for ourselves will start flickering, right? So we have to filter out things that we allow to enter into our mind through our senses. But this is only for some time, right? We cannot say that I'm going to completely shut myself out of all kinds of influence from outside. Now imagine the same lamp with a small flame when it becomes a healthy fire, when it becomes a configuration. The same breeze and wind which was there to put this off will now start making this fire grow more when the breeze starts coming, right? And that is what happens when the resolve becomes so strong that the breeze now does not put it off or shake it, but only strengthens it. And the same thing is being referred to by Krishna in this particular verse. He says, when karma yoga is followed, eventually, buddhi or discrimination transcends the dark forest of delusion, the moha kalilam. Once that happens, the words of others will not confuse you anymore or disturb your resolve anymore. Krishna says, shrotavyasya shrutasya cha. What you are going to hear and what you have already heard too. So to take our discrimination to that state, Krishna says karma yoga is helpful. And just like when the flame of a lamp becomes a configuration, the wind only helps it further, The words you hear after this resolve has become so strong through Karma Yoga, whatever you hear will only make this resolve stronger and stronger, right? The other way of looking at this particular verse is in the context of what Krishna was telling about the Vedas and the scriptures in a few verses before in the second chapter that we went through, where he spoke of Pushpitam Vacham, right? He said the flowery words or the flowery interpretations of the scriptures. So what disturbs our discrimination is also the misinterpretation of the scriptures. That can also be overcome through the practice of Karma Yoga. I think I'd spoken about this sometime back in the beginning of the Gita series itself. The inner meaning behind the imagery of Krishna being the charioteer, right? That's a very, very powerful thing. Because according to the very famous analogy which we have quoted and we go back to so very often of the Kathopanishad, where the body is the chariot, the senses are the horses, and the buddhi is the charioteer. That is the analogy of the Kathopanishad. But when you say that Krishna becomes the charioteer, when Krishna is taking the seat of the charioteer, it means that it is akin to one making the guru the buddhi, right? This is what I mentioned in the beginning of today's program too. We are making the guru or the guru's words or the guru's explanations the buddhi. As far as our buddhi has not come to that stage where we can say that it is beyond any delusion or the moha kalilam, we make the words of the guru the buddhi of reference. In a way, that is what we are trying to do in this program too, right? There are many, many ways of interpreting the Bhagavad Gita. And I think in the introductory episode, I had spoken of how people tend to misinterpret Gita, and especially those who want to take a violent step towards anything, you know, they tend to quote the Gita and say that, oh, violence is justified, right? These are all misinterpretations of the Gita that people can do. But when we take Swami's words, and that's what we are doing, we are taking Swami's discourses, we are taking Swami's Gita Vahini, and we know the general philosophy of Swami, or at least I think we can't say that we know, but at least we have a little bit of idea. With a little bit of reverence, we can say that we have a fair idea of what is Swami's philosophy. And we always keep that as the guidance, or that as the guiding light when we go through the Bhagavad Gita, or for that matter, any scripture or any Veda or Vedanta, right? And in that case, what happens is we will be able to understand what is the right import of whatever we read or whatever we hear, right? And that is what will happen, that eventually the buddhi becomes strengthened. Eventually, anything else that would have been a distraction, if I read some contorted description of Vedanta or some wrong interpretation of the Vedanta, I will be able to read it and I will be able to effortlessly filter out what is a misinterpretation or what is a misunderstanding by the author and take what is necessary, right? So in that same manner as the analogy that we spoke about, in that stage the buddhi becomes so strong that those words which would have otherwise distracted or distorted the buddhi now becomes a means of strengthening the buddhi. The flame becomes strengthened by the same breeze that would have put it off when it was a small flame, right? So we will be eventually be able to discriminate on our own. And when that happens, we will be able to naturally take what has to be taken and discard what is not right. But going back to the verse that we are discussing, what Krishna has been telling, these are all, if you look at it, very, very practical ways of achieving that sort of discrimination and that sort of purity of mind. All that he is saying is do your duty, do it with excellence, do it even when results are not favorable. That way, eventually and slowly, you will develop detachment. In turn, more diligence and duty will come. And this cycle of, you know, diligence and duty and excellence in action and detachment towards the fruit will eventually lead to Chitta Shuddhi. And when Chitta Shuddhi comes, discrimination will transcend delusion. And eventually, it will help us transcend birth and death itself, good and bad, sin and merit, and all such dualities, right? That is what Krishna has been explaining through this entire section of the second chapter, and he reiterates in this particular verse, that is verse number 52. In fact, he is going to continue that in the next verse, and as I said, the next verse is, it can be considered as more or less a summary of whatever Krishna has been telling. So we listen to verse number 53. I'll give you a short meaning and we'll discuss about it after that.
Shruti vipratipannate yadasthasyati nishchala samadhavachala buddhihi tadayogamavapsyasi.
When your mind is no longer disturbed by the flowery language of the Vedas, and when it remains fixed in the trance of transcendental consciousness, then you will have attained yoga or union. So that's verse number 53. So Krishna, as I said, reiterates what is that state of you attaining that yoga buddhi or buddhir yuktaha, whatever Krishna has been describing. And in a way, this is also a rephrasing of what Krishna had said earlier about samatvam yoga uchyate. Having that equanimity is what is referred to as yoga. But this verse again refers to the Shrutis or the Vedas and their misinterpretations. Of course, Krishna doesn't call them misinterpretations, but these are all offerings in the Vedas. If you look at it, the Vedas do say that if you want wealth, you can do this particular worship or yajna. You want long life, you can do an Ayur Yajna or whatever it is, right? But these are all offerings which are there in the Veda. These are not the misinterpretations of the Veda, but when we say that the Vedas are meant only for this, as I said that we can say this even about human life. Yes, in human life you can do and earn and lead a comfortable life. That is not wrong. But to think that that alone is the role of human life is what is the misinterpretation. So similarly, to say that you can get health from the Vedas, you can get wealth from the Vedas is not wrong. But to say that that alone is what the Vedas is meant for is wrong. Right? So that is the misinterpretation that Krishna is referring to. So he goes on to say in this particular verse, he says, Shruti vipratipanna means not being distracted by these various offerings or the misinterpretations of the Shrutis. Shrutis are again Vedas. But the word Shruti also means that which is heard. So this particular statement that Krishna is making could also be generalized in saying that when you say Shruti vipratipanna, not being distracted by what you hear from others, right? That's what we discussed in the last verse, that we have a resolve, we have a certain understanding of what we have to do, but what we hear from others confuses us. And when we say Shruti, it also means whatever we take in the form of input through our senses. That begins to unsettle us and shake us a little bit. So he says, Shruti vipratipannaha, not being distracted by either the Vedas or by what you hear from others. Stasyati nischala, and being, remaining unmoved, right? Stasyati means being firm. Nischala means not shaking at all, right? Stasyati nischala, and being, remaining unmoved. Samadhau achala buddhihi, and when the mind is firmly established in samadhi. Swami defines samadhi as a state where one is completely drawn within and is established in that contact with the divinity within, right? That is what Swami would refer to as samadhi, when you're completely drawn within and you are in touch with your divine self. So Krishna says here, samadhau achala buddhihi. The buddhi is firmly established in the state of samadhi. Tada yogam avapyasi. Then you would have attained the true state of yoga. That's what Krishna says. Tada yogam avapyasi. What Krishna is saying here is very, very important, right? Our focus should be to go beyond distractions. That is one thing that we have established. Whatever tempting words are spoken by others, it should not shake our resolve. In other words, it should not tempt us, right? What is it that distracts us? The temptation is that which distracts us. The words alone don't distract us, right? If somebody is going to come and tempt me in a language I don't understand, it is not going to distract me at all, right? You could tell me anything in Lithuanian or in Chinese, it is not going to distract me. Because I don't understand what is being told. The words themselves will never distract. But the temptation that is caused is the distraction, right? So one thing is, we must look beyond that distraction, or we should not allow others' words to distract us. But also, there should be a focus within too. The focus or the constant contact with the path or the goal. Let's say I'm asleep or I'm in a state of deep sleep. I give you an example of somebody telling words which I don't understand. Similarly, when I'm asleep, how much ever you come and tell me or how much ever you put a very, very expensive thing in front of me, I'm not going to be distracted by that. Because I'm not in a state of mind to see what you're doing. Or let's say I'm unconscious, I've just fallen into a dead faint. You cannot distract me when I'm in such a state. Similarly, think of it when, there's a small child. You cannot tempt a small child with a diamond necklace. Or you say shares of a company, I'm going to give you this very, very expensive shares of a company. You're not going to be able to distract a child or tempt a child with that. For a child, a diamond is a piece of stone. Shares or bonds or whatever it is nothing but pieces of paper which is going to tear up, right? That is not going to tempt a child because being ignorant is similar to being unconscious or being asleep. Just like how you cannot tempt me when I'm asleep, you cannot tempt me when I'm ignorant about the value of what you're tempting me with. So which means there is a possibility that today I'm not tempted, but tomorrow I might be tempted by it, right? When me not being tempted by it is out of my ignorance, I am not future-proof from being tempted by that. That's why Swami would say there's this particular discourse where Swami says that people often tell that we must give up body consciousness, dehabhimanam, right? Swami would say, Swami said in that discourse, people often say that you all should just give up dehabhimanam, that is the goal of the spiritual path. Swami said that is not very difficult. What is so difficult about that? And Swami says in that discourse, if you just drink one bottle of wine, dehabhimanam potundi, Swami said, right? Because you're going to pass out, or any kind of substance, drug abuse you take, you involve in some kind of drug abuse, then you'll be knocked off, right? Dehabhimanam will go. But Swami said, see, it is not important only to give up dehabhimanam. Even as dehabhimanam goes, you should develop atmabhimanam. Swami said, dehabhimanam povali, atmabhimanam ravali. Even as you give up body consciousness, you have to develop atmic consciousness, right? And that is what Krishna is telling in this particular shloka. He says, shruti vipratipanna te yada stasyati nischala. You should not be distracted by the flowery, fancy and tempting words that you hear and be stable in your focus, right? That is one part of what he is saying. But also that stability must be from samadhau achala buddhihi. That stability should come out of the buddhi or the mind that is focused in samadhi or in that state within, right? One part of it is you should not be distracted, and the other part is you should be established in that samadhi state, right? Only then you will not be distracted, and that is what when Krishna said in the previous one, you will not be distracted by what you have already heard, you will not be distracted by what you are going to hear. That is what is the future proofing, and that will happen only if both of these things are there. So in other words, our cravings and desires must be constantly for the higher things in life. And for that, the constant reminder of what Krishna told right in the beginning of the second chapter is very, very important. We have to constantly keep reminding ourselves that we have lived 100 lifetimes, that this body is ephemeral, all this worldly wealth and authority in life is all fleeting, and we are not this body, and we are not attached to the people who are in this body. All of these things what came under the Sankhya Yoga section of the second chapter, it is meant for mananam or meant for contemplation and recontemplation, so that our focus is fixed on the higher things, right? Not all of us might say that samadhau achala buddhihi, right? None of us have that kind of firm establishment in the samadhi. So does that mean that I cannot take to this path? No, you constantly remind yourself of the higher goals that you've set for yourself, right? We have to constantly keep reminding ourselves of all of these things. No one can tempt me with something that has become irrelevant to me, right? And the means of making all of these temptations irrelevant is we go back to these truths which Swami has been repeating again and again in his discourses, which Krishna has told here, right? If we look at our own lives, right? Because most of these things, we have done it in our lives. As we grow in age, so many things have become irrelevant to us. they no more tempt us, right? When we were kids, we used to be so easily tempted by a small toffee, you know, toys and comics used to tempt us so much. And when we were children, all our dealings used to be in comics and toys, right? You give me this and I will not tell mother that you did this. Because we used to be tempted by that. Can we be tempted by those toys today? When we were children, our parents would tell us, if somebody offers you a toffee, if a stranger comes and gives you a toffee, don't take it. Because we know that the child is capable of being distracted with something as silly, as simple as a toffee. But will we be distracted by the same toffee today? We have outgrown that temptation, right? Of course, we have different kind of temptations today. We have different kind of desires and distractions today. But there are certain distractions that we have outgrown, right? Similarly, all these distractions, what we are talking about, can be outgrown. We should remember that it is not that we cannot overcome all of these things. These things can also be made irrelevant to us. And the way of doing that is when we are able to constantly remind ourselves of the ephemeral nature of everything that people are running after, right? If somebody comes and tells you, oh, if you do this, you can become very famous. If you do this, if you be a little more selfish in business, you're going to make a lot of money. But if I'm constantly reminding myself of the nature of life, my own spiritual nature, the futility of all the worldly achievements, the importance of sticking to dharma, right? And if I constantly go back to doing my swadharma, not letting all of these things distract me because I'm constantly contemplating on the truths which Krishna has been telling. This becomes yoga buddhi, right? Then there will come a time when no interpretations of what life is and how life has to be led and what is the purpose of life will be able to distract me. No special tempting offer that can be found in, as Krishna is saying, in the Vedas can now distract me or tempt me from pursuing my goal. Then I would have achieved the union. Yogam avapyasi, he says. So that is the whole process. So almost very beautiful summary has been given in this particular verse where Krishna says, in the past 3 or 4 verses, you can say that he has given the picture of the ultimate, right? If I start doing karma yoga from tomorrow, it's not that day after tomorrow I'm going to transcend birth and death. It is a slow process. It's probably a process of many, many lifetimes. But this will eventually ultimately lead to that. And that is a promise, right? That is a promise being given by the Lord himself, right? That's why constantly the word Bhagwan keeps coming up in the Bhagavad Gita, because this is a promise by the Lord himself. It is not a promise by a guru. It is not a promise by somebody who is a little more learned than me. This is the promise of the person who has created this entire system, this entire cosmos. He is saying that today if you start doing karma yoga, today you start being a little detached, today you start being a little more focused on what is your dharma, eventually it will lead to chitta shuddhi, it will lead to this kind of jnana, it will lead to you being established in your samadhi, it will be leading you to a state where nothing on this earth can distract you from being focused on your goal, right? This is the promise that Krishna is giving. So in this particular verse, more or less, Krishna kind of sums up whatever he's been telling about Buddhi Yoga, right? He started off by saying that I'm going to teach you the yoga of the Buddhi. And probably you can say that in a sense, this is where it concludes. But the next verse is interesting. We'll listen to that. And it's interesting for a couple of reasons. We'll listen to that verse. As always, I'll give you the meaning and then we'll discuss about it. This is verse number 54 of the second chapter.
Arjuna uvacha sthita prajnyasya ka bhasha samadhisthasya keshava sthita dhih kim prabhasheta kimasita vrajeta kim.
Arjuna said, O Keshava, what is the description of a man of steady wisdom who is self-absorbed? How does the man of steady wisdom speak? How does he sit? How does he move about? So the previous verse, as I mentioned, was somewhat like a summary of what Krishna was explaining about all of this Buddhi Yoga and what is required to be a Karma Yogi, and if you're a Karma Yogi, how will your actions be and how will your state to be after you perform the actions. And possibly, like, if you just imagine the scene as Krishna narrating this whole thing to Arjuna, probably Krishna must have paused for some time after telling all of this. And imagine if Arjuna had said, okay, Krishna, I got your point. Point well taken, I understand. So let's go back and let's start fighting. So the Bhagavad Gita would have technically ended at this point, because this is the crux of whatever Krishna has been trying to explain to Arjuna, right? The whole idea is to make Arjuna do his duty. And if you look at it, till this section itself is complete, then that's the beauty of Bhagavad Gita. Just till this point of the 53rd verse of the second chapter, this itself is such a beautiful book of knowledge. It can be a standalone book of knowledge in that sense, right? But had Arjuna said, thank you, Krishna, let's go and fight, the rest of the Bhagavad Gita would have been lost to humanity. And thankfully, Arjuna doesn't do that. Arjuna raises a question, right? That's what he asks a question. What does he say? He says, in this verse, it starts with Arjuna Uvacha. Arjuna spoke, Keshava, O Keshava Krishna, Stita Prajnasya, Samadhistasya. A Stita Prajna, one who is established in Samadhi. Stita Prajna, I'll explain that word a little more now. Samadhistasya, one who is established in Samadhi. Ka Bhasha, what is his description? Ka Bhasha means what is his description? The word Stita Prajna, I think in the beginning of the second chapter I did mention this. It's a very beautiful and very, very potent word. And it's very interesting that Arjuna is using it even before Krishna is using it. Swami would say Prajna means awareness, right? Prajna is also a word that Swami uses for constant integrated awareness. But Prajna as a limited word, if you don't look at it from the complete spiritual connotation of the word Prajna, as a word, Prajna means awareness, and more precisely awareness of one's own divinity, right? So when you say Stita Prajna, Stita means to be stable, to be steady. So a Stita Prajna is one whose knowledge that one is not the body and one is the divine Atma is stable and constant. Samadhistasya is also in a sense a rephrasing of the same word Stita Prajna. There's another beautiful definition that Swami gives for Samadhi. Dhi means the intellect, Buddhi we say, right? Dhi means intellect or the mind. So Samadhi means one whose mind is always in a constant, undisturbed state. And it is undisturbed because it is turned within. Some would say that we all experience Samadhi in everyday life, right? It is only great yogis experience Samadhi. Some would say that Samadhi is being experienced by all of us. And in fact, that is what keeps us alive. That is what keeps us attentive and gives us the ability to do whatever we are doing. Because Swami would say Samadhi is what you get into when you are in the deep sleep state. And when you're in that deep sleep state, the mind is in a state where it cannot be disturbed by external stimuli, right? If I'm in a very, very deep sleep, I'm lying down just like I told you in the previous verse. How much ever you come and sit next to me and try to tempt me and you know, speak words by saying that, oh, you know, there is a lottery going on there, or, you know, so-and-so is promising such a property. All that will not be disturbing me because I'm in a state of deep sleep where external stimuli do not reach my brain, right? So we are in that state of Samadhi, but the problem is we are in that state of Samadhi for a very, very brief time. I'm in a deep sleep. The moment I wake up, my first thought is, oh, what day is it today? Oh God, today is a Monday. Oh, my work starts. So today is a Sunday. I can relax. Or, oh, today is an exam day, right? So the moment you wake up, the Samadhi state ends and then the ups and downs of the mind begin, right? But the Stita Prajna is a Samadhistaha, which means he's in a state of Samadhi even after waking up, right? That is what is the beauty of somebody who is established in the self, that one whose mind is in that state of Samadhi in all states of consciousness, be it wakefulness, dream state, deep sleep state, or even the state beyond, which is Turiya, right? So one who is in that deep sleep state even while awake is a Stita Prajna, right? Of course, the description, we leave it to Krishna to give. This is still the question. Arjuna is still asking the question. He says, a Stita Prajna whose awareness is constant and who is a Samadhistaha, who is in that state of samadhi constantly. It is not like he's in a state of samadhi only when he's on bed, but constantly, even when he's operating, even when he's talking, even when he's responding, even when he's fighting a battle, can somebody be in that samadhi sthaha, the state of constant samadhi? That is, we'll leave it again to Krishna to explain. But that's what he says. He is in a state of samadhi even while awake. For now, we are still in Arjuna's question, right? It is not Krishna's answer still. The other interesting point about this particular verse, why is this particular thing which Arjuna is asking is important? He says, sthita dehi kim prabhashate. Arjuna uses another word for sthita prajna. He says, sthita dehi, one whose mind is not shaken by anything. Right? So all of these words are Arjuna's words. They are still not Krishna's words. These are what he has understood from what Krishna has been telling so far. Right? So he says, sthita dehi kim prabhashate. How does such a person talk? Or what does he talk? Kim prabhashate? Kim asit vrajate kim? How does he sit? How does he move about? Right? That's what he is asking. What is the description of his sthita prajna? And he says, kim prabhashate? How does he speak or what does he speak? Kim asit vrajate kim? How does he sit? How does he stand or how does he walk? Now, these questions on the face of it may appear a bit silly, or, you know, why would you want to know how he speaks or how he stands or how he sits? Or why this idea that all sthita prajnas should have the same way of walking and talking? In fact, this kind of thinking is what leads to people pretending to be wise, right? If they walk slowly, let's say if they speak with a drowsy voice, head is swaying in a certain way, their hands are moving in a certain way, then people think, oh, here is a great saint. Because in our mind, we think that somebody who is a jnani will have these kind of physical attributes, or the way they carry themselves will be in a similar manner, right? But it need not necessarily be like that, right? But then why is Arjuna asking these questions? From the description that Krishna has given for a karma yogi, one who is in a state of samatvam always, whose nature is nirdvandva, which means the dualities do not affect him. He is a nir-yoga kshema. He is not bothered about achieving anything or protecting what he already has. He does not aspire for anything. He has no desire. He has no ambitions. Doesn't it make us all wonder, how will such a person act? What will be the inspiration for such a person to talk? Whenever we speak something, let's say we are sitting in a meeting in a boardroom and we express something, invariably it is to contribute something to what is happening. And to be able to contribute something, I should feel that my contribution is going to make a difference, right? Or when you're saying something, when you're doing something, you always feel that me doing this is going to result in something, and that result is going to be dear to me, right? If I feel that nobody is going to listen to me, I will say that, let me sit down, let me not talk, right? That's what would happen to parents also, right? Always you would hear this from parents. Nobody listens to me, so I'm going to stop talking. Nobody is listening to what I'm saying, so why should I give advice, right? So doesn't it occur to us that if somebody is so detached, somebody is so not interested in the results, what will be the inspiration for such a person to act? What will propel such a person to talk? What will inspire such a person to do anything in life, right? That question occurs to all of us, doesn't it? So that is what Arjuna is asking here. He is not interested in really how he talks or how he sits, or, you know, how many words per minute will he speak. That is not what Arjuna is interested in. That is why even if you look at Krishna's explanations or the answer that follows after this, Krishna will be referring to the import or the idea behind the question rather than the question. As we always say on the other shows, we have made this point. An intelligent person might answer the questions that are being asked, but the master will answer the questioner who is posing the question, right? And that is a typical example is what we are going through right now. Arjuna is asking a question, but there is something else running in his mind, right? And you will see that Krishna is answering the doubt which is in his mind and not necessarily the words that he has put forth, right? So that is one very important point about this particular verse, that though he is asking how does he speak, how does he talk, how does he sit, the idea behind it is, why would such a person really do anything, right? And if a person continues to do something, then there must be something that is inspiring that person. And that is what Arjuna is asking about. But there's one more very, very interesting thing about this shloka, and probably I'll mention that and we can conclude with that. It's a very interesting small anecdote regarding that. As we saw in this particular verse, Arjuna refers to Krishna as Keshava, right? And if we go back to the Gita Vahini, Swami, when he's writing about this shloka, Swami says a very interesting thing, which probably you will not find in other commentaries. It's not that I've read all the commentaries and I can say this with authority, but this is something which is interesting. Swami says in the Gita Vahini, and I quote, Krishna taught Arjuna the nature and characteristics of the person of steady wisdom when Arjuna questioned him. Arjuna prayed, O Keshava. And when the appellation Keshava was used, Krishna smiled, for he knew that Arjuna had understood his splendor. Do you ask how? Well, what does Keshava mean? It means he who is Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, the three forms. Through Krishna's grace, Arjuna had reached that stage of realization. End of quote. So what Swami is saying here is, when after so long Arjuna speaks, right? And when Arjuna speaks, he does not say Krishna, he says Keshava. And Swami is saying that when Arjuna said Keshava, Krishna gave a beautiful smile, because he acknowledges that Arjuna has understood that these are words of wisdom coming from no ordinary friend, no ordinary prince, no ordinary charioteer. It is coming from the Supreme Lord. And Swami said the word Keshava means one who is the embodiment of all the Trinity, Brahma, Vishnu and Maheshwara. The interesting thing about this particular verse that I wanted to mention is, when the Gita Vahini was being published in the Sanatan Sarthi as a serial, right? When this particular chapter, I think this comes in chapter number 5, was given to Professor Kasturi, he read these particular lines and he wondered, why is Swami written like this? Because the name Keshava comes to Krishna, as the popular belief goes. He gets the name because Krishna annihilates a particular demon called Keshi. There's a demon by name Keshi who takes the form of a horse. And we know the stories of Krishna's childhood, where so many demons are coming to attack him and he kills many of them. And even later in Krishna's life, he battles with a lot of demons. So there's this one particular demon in the form of a horse called Keshi, and because Krishna annihilates him, Krishna gets the appellation Keshava. So then when Professor Kasturi read this, he said, why is Swami writing like this? After all, Arjuna is saying Keshava, the one who killed Keshi. Listening to that, why should Krishna feel that Arjuna has understood my divinity, right? So when he read this particular thing, he was a little restless. He said, you can't go and ask Swami, right? So Professor Kasturi says that he had discussions with so many scholars who came to Parthi at that time, because, you know, those were the days when the Veda Pathshala was there. There were a lot of pandits used to come to take part in the Dashara Yajnam, and, you know, so many of Swami's devotees were scholars in Sanskrit. So a lot of them he sat with and he asked them the meaning of this, the word Keshava. And all of them kept telling that, yeah, this is from the episode of Keshi being killed. So he couldn't understand why Swami had written like this. I think he also made a trip to Bangalore to one particular mutt to have discussions with them, and he tried all of that, but he couldn't come to a conclusion. So after all that, he suddenly thought, you know, why am I going all over the place? Adi Shankara must have written about this somewhere, right? Of course, in the Bhashyam about Bhagavad Gita, this doesn't occur, but somewhere Adi Shankara must have written it. If I'm not wrong, if my memory serves me right, I think he finds it in the commentary that Adi Shankara has written for the Vishnu Sahasranama. Professor Kasturi says that, let me go and read Adi Shankara's commentary on this. Definitely this name will occur there, and definitely Adi Shankara would have given a meaning there. And when he reads it, to his surprise, Adi Shankara actually has written this, precisely what Swami has said. And he says, Keshava means, as we know, Kesha also means a hair, right? Kesha also means hair in Sanskrit. So Adi Shankara writes, Keshava means one whose one strand of hair has the potency of Brahma, Vishnu and Maheshwara. And he is the Supreme Lord, right? That is why he is called Keshava. And when he read this, Professor Kasturi was thrilled because that's precisely what Swami had written. So he was very, very happy, and apparently after that, Swami asked him, are you satisfied now? Have you cleared all your doubts? Have you asked all your friends and have you clarified all your doubts? Then Swami very sweetly and very beautifully, Swami said, it is not wrong, right? You are the editor of Sanatan Sarathi. So you have to do your background check. I'm not saying that it is wrong. And if you're satisfied, then you can print the article, right? So that is the small anecdote about this particular verse where Krishna is referred to as Keshava by Arjuna and why that is important. And what can we tell about our fortune that the same Lord is our master, the same Lord is our inspiration, the same Lord is our temptation, if I could say that, right? Because whenever we look at Swami, the joy of looking at Swami, the joy of loving Swami is so much that forget Stita Prajna, we are thinking of that state where we can constantly be in love with Swami, and that is what is driving us on the path of sadhana, right? So he has become the goal, he has become the path, he has also become the charioteer. He is the Sanatana Sarathi. So I join all of you in expressing my heartfelt gratitude to Swami for this. I'll join you all again next week to resume this triune pilgrimage of the Gita series. If you have any thoughts that you would like to share with me, if you have any comments, if I've said something wrong that you want to correct, please feel free to write to our feedback mail, listener@radiosai.org. Of course, you can now send us your feedback even through our WhatsApp number, 9393258258. That's the WhatsApp number. I'll repeat it again. 9393258258. Thank you. Happy listening.